Chapter 17. The months came and went. The drama and tragedy of the future were yet to come upon the stage, and in the meantime we pounded nuts and lived. It was a good year, I remember, for nuts. We used to fill gourds with nuts and carry them to the pounding places. We placed them in depressions in the rock, and, with a piece of rock in our hands, we cracked them, and ate them as we cracked. It was the fall of the year, when Lopir and I returned from our long adventure journey, and the winter that followed was mild. I made frequent trips to the neighborhood of my old home tree, and frequently I searched the whole territory that lay between the blueberry swamp and the mouth of the slough, where Lopir and I had learned navigation, but no clue could I get of the Swift One. As he had disappeared. And I wanted her. I was impelled by that hunger which I have mentioned, and which was akin to physical hunger, albeit it came often upon me when my stomach was full. But all my search was vain. Life was not monotonous at the caves, however. There was Red Eye to be considered. Lopir and I never knew a moment's peace except when we were in our own little cave. In spite of the enlargement of the entrance we had made, it was still a tight squeeze for us to get in. And though from time to time we continued to enlarge, it was still too small for Red Eye's monstrous body. But he never stormed our cave again. He had learned the lesson well, and he carried on his neck a bulging lump to show where I had hit him with the rock. This lump never went away, and it was prominent enough to be seen at a distance. I often took great delight in watching that evidence of my handiwork, and sometimes, when I was myself assuredly safe, the sight of it caused me to laugh. While the other folk would not have come to our rescue had Red Eye proceeded to tear Lopir and me to pieces before their eyes, nevertheless they sympathized with us. Possibly it was not sympathy, but the way they expressed their hatred for Red Eye, at any rate they always warned us of his approach. Whether in the forest, at the drinking places, or in the open space before the caves, they were always quick to warn us. Thus we had the advantage of many eyes, in our feud with Red Eye, the atavism. Once he nearly got me. It was early in the morning, and the folk were not yet up. The surprise was complete. I was cut off from the way up the cliff to my cave. Before I knew it, I had dashed into the double cave, the cave where Lopir had first eluded me long years before, and where old Sabretooth had come to discomfiture when he pursued the two folk. By the time I had got through the connecting passage between the two caves, I discovered that Red Eye was not following me. The next moment he charged into the cave from the outside. I slipped back through the passage, and he charged out and around and in upon me again. I merely repeated my performance of slipping through the passage. He kept me there half a day before he gave up. After that, when Lopir and I were reasonably sure of gaining the double cave, we did not retreat up the cliff to our own cave when Red Eye came upon the scene. All we did was to keep an eye on him and see that he did not cut across our line of retreat. It was during this winter that Red Eye killed his latest wife with abuse and repeated beatings. I have called him an atavism, but in this, he was worse than an atavism, for the males of the lower animals do not maltreat and murder their mates. In this I take it that Red Eye, in spite of his tremendous atavistic tendencies, foreshadowed the coming of man, for it is the males of the human species only that murder their mates. As was to be expected, with the doing away of one wife, Red Eye proceeded to get another. He decided upon the Singing One. She was the granddaughter of Old Marrow Bone, and the daughter of the Hairless One. She was a young thing, greatly given to singing at the mouth of her cave in the twilight, and as he had but recently mated with Crooked Leg. He was a quiet individual, molesting no one, and not given to bickering with his fellows. He was no fighter anyway. He was small and lean, and not so active on his legs as the rest of us. Red Eye never committed a more outrageous deed. It was in the quiet at the end of the day, when we began to congregate in the open space, Before climbing into our caves, suddenly the singing one dashed up a runway from a drinking place, pursued by Red Eye. She ran to her husband. Poor little Crooked Leg was terribly scared. But he was a hero. He knew that death was upon him, yet he did not run away. He stood up, and chattered, bristled, and showed his teeth. Red Eye roared with rage. It was an offense to him that any of the folk should dare to withstand him. His hand shot out and clutched Crooked Leg by the neck. The latter sank his teeth into Red Eye's arm. But the next moment, with a broken neck, Crooked Leg was floundering and squirming on the ground. The singing one screeched and gibbered. Red Eye seized her by the hair of her head and dragged her toward his cave. He handled her roughly when the climb began, and he dragged and hauled her up into the cave. We were very angry, insanely, vociferously angry. Beating our chests, bristling, and gnashing our teeth, we gathered together in our rage. We felt the prod of gregarious instinct, the drawing together, as though for united action, the impulse toward cooperation. In dim ways this need for united action was impressed upon us. But there was no way to achieve it, because there was no way to express it. We did not turn to, all of us, and destroy Red Eye, because we lacked a vocabulary. We were vaguely thinking thoughts for which there were no thought symbols. These thought symbols were yet to be slowly and painfully invented. We tried to freight sound with the vague thoughts that flitted like shadows through our consciousness. The hairless one began to chatter loudly. By his noises he expressed anger against Red Eye and desire to hurt Red Eye. Thus far he got, and thus far we understood. But when he tried to express the cooperative impulse that stirred within him, his noises became gibberish. Then Big Face, with brow bristling and chest pounding, began to chatter. One after another of us joined in the orgy of rage, until even Old Marrowbone was mumbling and spluttering with his cracked voice and withered lips. Someone seized a stick and began pounding a log. In a moment he had struck a rhythm. Unconsciously, our yells and exclamations yielded to this rhythm. It had a soothing effect upon us. And before we knew it, our rage forgotten, we were in the full swing of a hee-hee council. These hee-hee councils splendidly illustrate the inconsecutiveness and inconsequentiality of the folk. Here were we, drawn together by mutual rage and the impulse toward cooperation, led off into forgetfulness by the establishment of a rude rhythm. We were sociable and gregarious, and these singing and laughing councils satisfied us. In ways the hee-hee council was an adumbration of the councils of primitive man, and of the great national assemblies, and international conventions of latter-day man. But we folk of the younger world lacked speech, and whenever we were so drawn together we precipitated Babel, out of which arose a unanimity of rhythm that contained within itself the essentials of art yet to come. It was art nascent. There was nothing long dash continued about these rhythms that we struck. A rhythm was soon lost, and pandemonium reigned until we could find the rhythm again, or start a new one. Sometimes half a dozen rhythms would be swinging simultaneously, each rhythm backed by a group that strove ardently to drown out the other rhythms. In the intervals of pandemonium, each chattered, cut up, hooted, screeched, and danced, himself sufficient unto himself, filled with his own ideas and volitions to the exclusion of all others, a veritable center of the universe, divorced for the time being from any unanimity with the other universe centers leaping and yelling around him. Then would come the rhythm, a clapping of hands, the beating of a stick upon a log, the example of one that leaped with repetitions, or the chanting of one that uttered, explosively and regularly, with inflection that rose and fell, a bang, a bang, a bang, a bang. One after another of the self-centered folk would yield to it, and soon all would be dancing or chanting in chorus. H-ha-ha, ha-ha, ha-ha-ha, was one of our favorite choruses, and another was, a-wa, a-wa, a-wa-ha. And so, with mad antics, leaping, reeling, and overbalancing, we danced and sang in the somber twilight of the primeval world, inducing forgetfulness, achieving unanimity, and working ourselves up into sensuous frenzy. And so it was that our rage against Red Eye was soothed away by art, and we screamed the wild choruses of the Hee-Hee Council until the night warned us of its terrors, and we crept away to our holes in the rocks, calling softly to one another, while the stars came out and darkness settled down. We were afraid only of the dark. We had no germs of religion, no conceptions of an unseen world. We knew only the real world, and the things we feared were the real things, the concrete dangers, the flesh and blood animals that preyed. It was they that made us afraid of the dark, for darkness was the time of the hunting animals. It was then that they came out of their lairs, and pounced upon one from the dark wherein they lurked invisible. Possibly it was out of this fear of the real denizens of the dark, that the fear of the unreal denizens was later to develop, and to culminate in a whole and mighty unseen world. As imagination grew, it is likely that the fear of death increased until the folk that were to come projected this fear into the dark, and peopled it with spirits. I think the fire people had already begun to be afraid of the dark in this fashion, but the reasons we folk had for breaking up our hee-hee councils and fleeing to our holes were old Saber-Tooth, the lions and the jackals, the wild dogs and the wolves, and all the hungry, meat-eating breeds. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.